I just wanted to show you a word out of there, and that's what I have on the overhead. Well, I can't find my passage I'm looking for. Yeah, no, that's not it. Well, okay. In Exodus chapter, we're going to be working on Exodus 22, verses 1 through 23:9 tonight. But in 21:1, by way of review, we have this statement: "Now these are the judgments which thou shalt set before them." And the word "the judgments" is the word ha-mishpatim. Ha is the article in Hebrew, the. Mishpatim is the word laws, or ordinances, or judgments. And then the passage I can't seem to find is the Book of the Covenant in 24, should be in the first seven verses. Yeah, verse 7, 24:7. Moses comes down off the mount, and he reads all these words to him. In verse 7 it says, "He took the book of the covenant and read in the audience of the people." Okay? So here it's called the Book of the Covenant. Okay? And what we have found that the nature of this section that runs from this Book of the Covenant actually runs from chapter 20 and verse 22 all the way through 23 verse 33. This is to be considered the Book of the Covenant, and the nature of that covenant is ha-mishpatim, or the ordinances, or the laws that are going to accompany the moral law and the religious law of Israel. Okay? Now, some of these sort of come like rapid fire shots at you, some of the laws we'll see tonight. Some of them have little paragraphs that deal with certain topical aspects of these judgments and so on. And this is not, I cannot find these the most inspiring of all passages to be studying. If your hair stands up on end tonight and spiritual tingles run down your spine, I'd be very interested to know about it. You're probably sick or something like that, or I don't know. Whatever the case, it's not the most inspiring. I have to force myself to study the Hebrew of this passage. But one of the reasons that I'm going through this very slowly is that you will find a lot of criticism of the Bible in this area. And you as a believer are responsible for an apology to answer that type of thing. And so if you don't even know what's written, how are you going to answer it? So I'm going to work, I'm in no real hurry to get through, because I feel that we should cover it somewhat thoroughly while we're in it, okay? In chapter 22, verses 1 through 4, you have certain laws relative to stealing and restitution. And one of the things that you should note in your Bible tonight is this concept of restitution. You should underline it. You will note that it is repeated throughout the context. And I didn't have a chance to look this up, but I have never found the statement, if the guy does this, you throw him in jail. I haven't come across that yet. The concept is you make them do restitution. And I'd be very interested, I'm going to look further on the word jail, prison in the context, and see if I can find it. I'm not sure we will. Okay, verse 1. "If a man steal an ox or a sheep, and he kills it or sells it," which means the sheep is gone, or the ox is gone for all practical purposes for the owner, "he shall restore 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. With, if nothing else, it would make him think twice before he stole the ox or the sheep, because the penalty is very severe. So in verse 1, the concept here is stealing in view of killing. Okay? And the idea is there is a severe penalty. Severe penalty. 5 to 1 in the case of an oxen, 4 to 1 in the case of a sheep. Now somebody would say, well, what about if they stole a camel, or maybe if they stole a boat? I don't know how the judges would determine. Perhaps there would be enough information here to set a value judgment. And it's very apparent that an oxen or an ox was much more valuable than a sheep was in that day. Okay. In verse 2 and 3 of this section, the emphasis is on the thief himself. The thief himself. Okay. Verse 2. If a thief be found breaking up or breaking in, or what we would call breaking and entering, and be smitten that he die. Now you'll notice that the King James supplies the verb. There's no verb in the Hebrew statement that follows. There is simply this literal statement that reads this way: no blood to him, which means there shall be no blood shed in regards to him. Okay? Now, you have to read the next verse in order to understand that breaking and entering apparently happened at night, because in verse 3, you have the same situation if the guy breaks in the daytime. If the sun be risen upon him, in that case, literally in Hebrew, blood unto him, or blood to him, which means there shall be blood shed for him, or for he should make full restitution. And that has to do with restitution. Let's get to the shedding of blood concept. In verse 2, you have a nighttime thief. A nighttime thief. All right? It's dark. The guy is forcefully entering your residence or maybe your business. Unlawful or forcible entry. And his motives are not apparent because it's dark. You do not know if he is armed. You do not know what kind of weaponry he has. And so you pick up the nearest thing, and maybe it's an axe. And you swing it around, and boom, you make contact somewhere below the cranium, about the neck. And the blood comes out and squirts all over, and before you can get it stopped, the guy's dead, and you're a mess, and so is the carpet. Too bad for the guy. Now, you had no idea. You are totally innocent. And so the concept is, if he's killed, no blood to him, which means that his kinsman, his nearest kinsman, is forbidden to revenge his death. Last week we saw, in case you weren't here, that in terms of capital punishment, that there were two forms. One could be done by the community, the other could be done by the nearest kinsman of the person that was murdered. That had to be justified, though. It had to be justifiable according to the law before one could do it. Okay? Okay, now verse 3 is a daytime thief. A daytime thief. And the implication is that this daytime thief, it is assumed in the passage, that this daytime thief was not planning murder, or he wasn't planning kidnapping. His weapons or his lack of weapons were clearly observable. And if you killed him, then you took your life in your own hands. You were open for revenge or retaliation under the law. Okay? So the daytime thief, blood would be to him. blood to him, which means that his nearest kinsman could take your life for taking his. In the latter part of verse 3, we have the concept of restitution. Okay, so you capture this person, and he's guilty, and if he's taken anything, then the demand is he should make full restitution. If he have nothing, then he should be sold for his debt. In other words, he is sold into temporary slavery to you until his debt is repaid. The details of that are not. What if the guy is sold to you, and then he won't work, or he causes you more trouble or more hassle? You don't have all the details of that spelled out in the law, but you have the concept of fairness under the law. This person has to make restitution for what the damages that he caused. I think it's just a tremendous concept, and it runs all the way through the law. This is the second time that we had it. Okay? Well, suppose that suppose he stole something and you're able to prove it, but he's gotten rid of it. I mean, he's hustled the goods off to some flea market, or perhaps he has a dealer in contraband, and so he doesn't have it, whatever he stole, or set for it. If the theft be certainly found in his hand alive, whether it be an ox or an ass or a sheep, then the command is he shall restore double. Okay? In other words, in this case, he hasn't sold it or killed it, and so in verse 4, you have the concept of double restitution. If he still holds the goods. Now, again, here is a person who's apt to be sold into temporary servitude. Somehow he has to restore the car that he... No, he has to restore two cars. Everybody praying that maybe your car will get stolen because you might get two back or something to that effect. Tremendous concept under the law. Okay? Okay. In verses 5 and 6, you see, verses 1 through 4 dealt with stealing and restitution. Okay? Now verses 5 and 6. The concept here is restitution for property damage. Restitution for property damage. You're going to find, or we're going to find, or we're going to see, that throughout the law, the concept of respect for private property is continually reinforced. In other words, respect for private property in ancient Israel rated high in their value system. On a scale of 1 to 10, it was a 10. Destruction of personal property was considered a very, very serious offense. Even accidental damage to private property is covered. The first thing that Moses is led to cover is the intentional consuming of another's fields. Okay? Okay, if a man shall cause a field or a vineyard to be consumed, interesting word here, the word, and also interesting that the King James finally translates or interprets for us a hifil stem. That's exciting to me. I think this is a second one we found. Did you notice? If a man shall cause a field, okay, a man causes. That's an interpretation of the stem, proper interpretation. A field to be consumed. I'm excited that we have 4 or 5 Hebrew students now, and it's important that we point out some of these exegetical aspects of Hebrew. This is a hifil stem. In Hebrew, you have an action slot, and the hifil action slot is causative action. In other words, the person who is the subject of the verb causes the thing to be done. Okay? This is the hifil stem of bacher. Bacher. Excuse me. B-A. I'm not sure about the vowel pointing on this verb. I didn't write it down. Bacher. Now, ba'er normally means to be burned up with fire, but it can mean to consume or to be eaten up. Okay? Now, in the context here, it has to be eaten up. So, if a man shall cause a field to be consumed, and shall put in his beast, and shall feed on another man's field. Now, let's stop right there. Here, your neighbor goes on vacation. And the grain is just looking real good. And you say, oh, geez, on vacation, I'll water my lawn with this hose. No, you wouldn't. Nobody would do that in Denver. I'm going to put my sheep in there. They won't eat that mat. And in they go, and they just devour this field. Or suppose a guy's vineyard is really looking good, you know, and so at night you raid the vineyard. All right? Now that is intentional, consuming of some other's personal property. And what's going to be the proof? All you have with the sheep are waste materials laying all over the place. They could analyze that and say, this came from this guy's field. Well, if they can prove it, look what happens. Of the best of his own field and of the best of his own vineyard shall he make restitution. So restitution. And it doesn't say that they consume the best of the other field. Maybe they just consume something that wasn't so good. So the restitution has to do with the best of one's own. Okay? Pretty good. Makes a guy think twice. Okay? Now, however, it may be that the consuming or the destruction is unintentional. So in verse 6, we have unintentional destruction of another's property or personal holdings. Okay? In this case, it has to do, the case that's described is by fire. All right, let's read it. Notice how fair this is. If a fire break out and catch in thorns or thistles so that the stacks of grain, King James says corn, always where you have corn in King James, it means grain in Hebrew, or of the standing grain, or the field, be consumed therewith. He that kindled the fire shall surely make restitution. Maybe a guy is burning his the weeds along the irrigation ditch, and all of a sudden the wind changes direction, and or else blows some sparks over in your neighbor's grain field, and a guy's grain field catches on fire, and the whole thing is down the tubes. Tough luck for you if you're the one who was burning the weeds along the irrigation ditch. Again, verse 7, if a man shall deliver into his... Well, no, wait, let's stop right. He that kindled the fire shall surely make restitution. So some form of restitution has to be made for unintentional destruction, in this case by fire, of something that belonged to a neighbor. And you would replace grain for grain, or you would pay the going price for how much grain was destroyed. Okay, now how about a case where you say, well, I'm going on vacation, My mother-in-law died in Babylon, and I got to get the wife and get the camel loaded up and head over the Fertile Crescent, and you know, it's a long journey. What am I going to do with, what's my wife going to do with her jewels? Well, maybe she doesn't have that. What are we going to do with the valuables that we have, whatever was valuable? Maybe some camel saddles. Maybe your hot water foot bath vibrator. Really, in that day, safety deposit boxes were hard to come by in the ancient world. There were banks, but they were very few, and security was at a premium. Warehouses were unheard of. Storage vaults were very hard to come by. And so it was a very, very customary thing that you took what is valuable. You took your stereo and your television, and you dumped it on a neighbor when you went somewhere for any length of time. Otherwise, it probably would be gone. Now, what if somehow the neighbor mishandles that, see? Or with whom you left that, it's not there when you come back. All right? Even that is covered in this section. Point 3, which is chapter 22, verse 7 through 13, the concept of breach of trust. Breach of trust. And this breach of trust is with property, okay? Relative to property. Tangible physical property. Okay, the first thing he covers in verse 7 through 9 is if the goods are stolen. And there would be always two possibilities when this happened. It could be a thief that stole them, or maybe the guy that you entrusted them with, maybe he got his hands in the goods. So, verse 7. If a man shall deliver unto his neighbor money or stuff, I didn't look that word up. How's that translated in New American? Goods, yeah, stuff. Stuff is a good old English word, isn't it? To keep. And it be stolen of the man's house, if the thief be found, let him pay double. Again, concept restitution. And in this case, verse 7, it was a crook, an honest-to-goodness crook. Could we call it that? Yeah, he's a real genuine crook. Okay, so verse 7 is a genuine crook. Oh, they had genuine crooks back in. They have had genuine crooks ever since Adam and Eve, and we will always have genuine. And there will always have to be some determination of what we're going to do with genuine crooks. I think they had a better system under the law than what we have today, to be honest with you. Today we lock them up with violent criminals, and everybody ends up in violence. Or the prison system in the United States is a real tragedy, really a problem. Well, this guy, instead of sending him to jail, you made him pay back double. And if he couldn't pay back, he was sold in servitude. Okay. It's possible, however, that the master of the house might be involved in the matter, the person that you left the goods with. So the issue then is the problem of the master, by the master, or the one into whose hands you entrusted the goods. Verse 8 and verse 9. If the thief be not found, then the master of the house shall be brought unto, the King James says, unto the judges. Now, I want to read the whole passage. If you look at verse 8, you have the word the judges, and if you look at verse 9, you have the word the judges twice. Now it looks to me like if you're going to be consistent, you have to be consistent in both places. It should mean the same in both places. You're aware that wherever you have the word judges in the judges, or if you have the judges, you have Ha Elohim. The judges equals excuse me, Ha Elohim. This is the, and this is Elohim. And the Elohim can mean what? The God, Elohim. Or it can mean, you wouldn't translate this gods, not in this case, because he's referring to authority figures. You always have the concept of sovereignty in the word Elohim. So this can mean either the God, capital G, or the judges. But it looks to me like you should be consistent when you translate it, I don't think the New American Standard Version is consistent. I think they translated God in verse 8 and judges in verse 9. And we will find this repeated in the passage. We already had it in 21:6. We now have it in 22:8. We have it in 22:9. We have it in 22:28 and 28. Okay? Now I think it's best translated the judges. And the implication is, if that's correct translation, is that they had duly appointed judges in every place. We have always had to have this historically. There has to be somebody who sits behind the bench and he listens to the objective evidence and he weighs the objective evidence. Okay? So, the point is this, verse 8. If the thief be not found, then the master of the house shall be brought unto the judges, to see whether he hath put his hands into his neighbor's goods. For all manner of trespasses, whether it be for ox, for ass, for sheep, for raiment, or for any manner of lost thing which another challenges to be his, the cause of both parties shall come before the judges. And whom the judges shall condemn, he shall pay double unto his neighbor. So great authority was placed into the hands of the judgment, the mishpat, of the judges. And again, the concept, you never left anyone off scot-free. There was always restitution if they were guilty. Okay? Okay. Now, this was a case where somebody volitionally put something into the hands of a neighbor or somebody in order to protect it for maybe a certain period of time. Now, what about the case where you reverse that? In other words, you go to the neighbor and you say, hey, lend me your lawnmower. Can I borrow your lawnmower? I mean, I just bought this new house and I got to cut the weeds and I'm going to get a lawnmower, but until I do, can I just borrow it once, okay? Or lend me your electric hair clippers. Or lend me your electric drill. The last case I had was an electric drill with a drill bit. And when I got the electric drill and the drill bit back, it was dark and I didn't look at it. And then when I did look at the drill bit was ruined. And the guy who had borrowed it was in North Dakota. He had gotten divorced and sold the house. What about that case? All right. This is the next section, verse 10 through 13. I'm sorry. Wait a minute. I skipped. This section should... Yeah, this... Well... My outline wrong. No. Verse 10 through 13. This should really run through 13. And that borrowing thing is after that. Let me finish this first. I got ahead of myself. Verse 10 through 13 is simply the concept of establishing guilt. Establishing guilt in cases of breach of trust. If a man deliver unto his neighbor an ox or an ass or sheep or any beast to keep, and it dies or be hurt or driven away, and no man sees it, then shall an oath, not of the Lord, but an oath before the Lord, be between them both, that he hath not put his hand into his neighbor's goods. And the owner of it shall accept thereof, and he, that is, the man into whose hands it was given, shall not make it good. No, he's not held liable. And if it be stolen from him, he shall make restitution unto the owner thereof. If it be torn to pieces, then let him bring it for a witness, and he shall not make good that which was torn. Okay? Okay, so you have a case of that something was delivered into his hands, and he was responsible for it, and it was stolen, and hence he had to make it good. But if it was destroyed or something to that effect, and he could produce the evidence, then he did not. He was not responsible. So the whole concept in verses 10 through 13 is establishing guilt in cases of breach of trust and relative to restitution. Okay, now it's the next section, verse 14 and 15, where we have borrowed items. Borrowed items. Okay? The main concept is that the borrower is liable for what he borrows unless the owner stays with the thing that is lent. Verse 14. If a man borrow anything of his neighbor and it be hurt or dies, you borrow a horse. Hey, can I borrow your horse? I want to go elk hunting. And you go elk hunting and you lose the horse. How many remember that? I do. Then the guys who borrow the horse have to pay for the horse. Okay? If a man borrow anything of his neighbor and it be hurt or dies, the owner thereof not with it. In other words, the owner doesn't go along to sort of watch over the thing. He shall surely make it good. So this is the key thing. The borrower is liable. The borrower is liable unless the owner stays with the thing lent. Okay. But if the owner thereof be with it, he shall not make it good. If it be a hired thing, it came for his hire. If the owner stays with it, then the person who's borrowing it is not responsible. And the idea is that the owner is there to sort of watch over it. If something happens to it, well, then it's too bad in terms of his. He has to suffer the loss. Okay? I've noticed in terms of horses for elk hunting, I've been dealing with a man. Here's what's happened in Colorado. I'll tell you what the story is happening. In all the you're all interested in this, aren't you? I mean, this is vital information. There are major elk hunting areas in Colorado, like the Upper Rio Grande and the White River. And the farmers there used to let you pack out an elk for $50. They'd say, okay, here's the horse, here's the panniers. You go get the horse and have the elk out and bring the horse back in one day, $50. But sometimes a guy would lose the horse, the panniers would get tore up, they'd bring it back, tore up, and the farmer would have a terrible time. trying to get the guy to pay for it. Maybe he'd lose the tech gear. Oh, geez, city slickers are so dumb. So, along came a good entrepreneur and said, hey, hundreds of guys are hunting. He says, I'll lease all the horses. And so in all of these areas, every horse is leased by one guy. And he guarantees the rancher X amount of money for the horse for the whole season. He'll rent it for the whole season. He will guarantee that the horse will come back and all the tack gear again. Then he takes the individuals who are going to rent the horse and you sign your life away. I mean, you sign your life away. Every horse is worth an absolute fortune, even the oldest nag. The last nag that we had, and I put an elk on it, laid down on me in the middle of the mountain. It's midnight. It's midnight, and I'm packing this elk on this horse, and the hill is about that steep, and it's frozen, and he begins to slip, and he's tired, and I'm worse, more tired than he is, and he lays down with a half an elk on his back. I mean, that nag should have been shot right there. Yeah, oh boy, was that a, oh, that horse was really worth the dough. I mean... The point is that when you borrow something or you rent something, if you are the one who is renting it out or lending it out, you find out pretty quick you've got to put some restrictions on that thing, and you better get it down in writing or you're going to suffer. You're going to suffer. You see? So the man that's in the business of renting out, he finds that out. And I've noticed these contracts every year, they get more and more explicit, more and more demanding. And the reason is because some screwed up jerk has gone over and abused the animal, in this case, horses. Okay. Under the law, under the civil law of Israel, that was covered. And it's very, very fair. Okay? Okay, the next section is a little section that has to do with... All of a sudden, he plunges into this thing of morals. Chapter 22, verse 16 and 17. Seduction. Seduction of a male. By a male. How should I say? No, yeah, by, not of. Seduction by a male of a non-engaged female. Here comes some Lothario who thinks he's hot stuff, and he entices a maid, we're told in verse 16. If a man entices a maid, and the concept of the word entice is a concept of seduction. And this maid is not engaged. She's not betrothed. She's not spoken for. And he lie with her, he shall surely endow her to be his wife. If her father utterly refused to give him unto her, maybe the father says, hey, I'm not going to have that jerk to be the wife of my daughter. Then the father has an option. And by the way, under the law, this is always the case. You see, under the Old Testament, I want you to consider this for just a second, okay? Under Old Testament and ancient concepts of human relationships, you never have this concept of romantic love like you have in the United States or in Western civilization. You don't have that concept of that sudden spark. Wow! Zappo, whammy, we're headed for the altar. And our pulses are really beating. And it was all predestined. It must be of God because it's so wonderful. You don't have any concept of romantic zappism. You do have the concept that two people can learn to love one another and give proper love manifestations to one another. And even under romantic Zappism, you better believe that that's true. The two people are going to have to learn what love is and how you give proper love expression, even if you got the zap to you. The whole thing was in the hands of the father. And the father says, no way am I going to have my daughter married to that jerk. So he makes the option and he says, that guy is going to pay money according to the dowry of virgins. Did you notice that? That word virgin? Okay. So the concept is, there's two possibilities for restitution. Restitution. One, forced marriage. Okay. The other one is payment of a dowry. For those of you interested in the problem of Alma and Bethula in terms of a virgin, the word that's translated maid in verse 16 is the word Bethula. The word that's translated Alma in verse 17, it's translated virgin, isn't it? Yeah, virgins. This is the word Alma. That's interesting because that's a switch. An Alma can be a young girl who is not a virgin. But a Bethula has to be a virgin. This should be translated virgin. He's talking about a virgin in the case. Okay? And it's an interesting play on these two words. And perhaps you've been familiar with the argument about Alma, a young woman shall conceive. Behold, I give you a sign. A young woman shall conceive. And the liberals say, why do all the fundamentalists want to translate Alma virgin in Isaiah 9:6? Alma in the Old Testament means young woman. And what they say is true. It can be translated young woman. But what kind of a sign would it be? What kind of a miraculous sign would it be if a young woman got pregnant? That's not a miraculous sign. The point I'm trying to make is that Alma can be a virgin. Here's a case where you have good, substantial evidence where Alma means virgin. And it means that in Isaiah 9:6 too. Okay? Okay. Let's hurry on. Maybe I'm going to finish this tonight. The next section, 22, verse 18 through 20. Here we have some rapid fire, one right after the other, three capital offenses. Capital offense is one that's punishable by death. And these relate to personal vileness and irreverence. All right? The first one is verse 18. Thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. And if you have a good margin, or if you have a good translation, you can see that the word witch should be translated sorceress. There's another word for witch. Now, will you notice that this is feminine? There is also a masculine form for this word, a sorcerer. Okay? The word that is used here is a sorceress. Okay? It's feminine. And it's kind of indicative that women were more apt to be involved in the occult. In fact, when you think about the illustrations of this actually happening in the Old Testament, I think that's what you find. I think you will find that the majority of them will be women, maybe all of them, I'm not sure. A woman is more susceptible to the occult, apparently. That's the teaching of Scripture. Sorry about that, ladies. Now, I've written myself a note to pick up on the occult in the law. and I'm going to do that. I'm going to take a whole session, I think, to deal with the occult under the law. But this is the first expression that we've had. A sorceress would not be permitted, not tolerated, to live. It's a form of capital punishment under the Israeli economy. And you can just simply write at this time in your notes, we're not going to take time to do it, Deuteronomy 18, verses 10 and 11, you have a delineation of the names of the various forms of occultism at that time. Okay? By the way, this is the verse that was the basis of the Salem witch trials in Salem, Massachusetts, in the late 17th century. And did you know there was a witch trial in North Carolina in 1979? Did you know that? Yeah, there was. Mm-hmm. Last year. I don't know what they would have done in North Carolina if they would have found her guilty. And it was another her, by the way. But in Salem, Massachusetts, because they were trying to establish a theocracy, because they thought they were a theocracy, they put the witches to the gallows. The judgment was, we cannot suffer a witch to live. And recently, on one of the Gary Tesler shows, this is a verse he likes to quote. He had a witch on his show, and he says, under the Old Testament, you wouldn't be allowed to live. He says, we're glad we're in a more cultured society today, and so on, making fun of the Bible. How would you answer that? See, how would you answer Gary Tesler on that? You have to answer that in the context in which Israel found itself, you see, and under which, in a theocracy in which you have a nation based upon regeneration and no freedom of religion at all. None. No way. It's the only way you're going to answer that issue. Okay? Well, we're going to deal more with a cult under the law later on. I want to try to finish this tonight. In the next one, we have to say a little bit about. The second capital offense in this trilogy of capital offenses is expressed in verse 9. Whosoever lieth with a beast, or we could translate it, whosoever has sexual intercourse with a beast shall surely be put to death. Okay? So this is bestiality. Bestiality is a broader term, but bestiality can include sexual relationship with a beast. Okay? Now, will you look? Put down some added references. I'm only going to have you look at one of these. Leviticus 18, 23 and 24, and Leviticus 20, verse 15 and 16. I'm recording these for you to show you that this is not an isolated concept, that it's repeated three times, four times in the law. But look at the 18th chapter of Leviticus and verse 23, which sort of explains a little bit about the perspective of this. 18:23. Neither shall previous verse speaks about homosexuality. Thou shalt not lie with mankind as with womankind. It is an abomination. It is a detestable thing from divine viewpoint. Neither shalt thou lie with any beast to defile thyself therewith. Neither shall any woman stand before a beast to lie down thereto. Then the King James says, it is confusion. See that? It is confusion. And whenever you have a construction in Hebrew where you don't have a verb, the fact of it's being emphasized, it simply says, it confusion. Now the word that's translated confusion means perversion. See? Bestiality is gross perversion. This word that is translated confusion will be used a number of times relative to sexual sins. Incest will be called by this same word. Okay? And it's expressing divine viewpoint. It is a gross perversion of the divine design. It is degrading. It is dehumanizing. Now I ask you, why is that in the Bible? Why does God have to say to human beings, you're not supposed to have sexual intercourse with animals. Why does he say that? Well, he says it very obviously because people were having sexual intercourse with animals. In fact, since the discovery of the Hittite library up in Turkey, 20,000 clay manuscripts, they have it written in a law that cohabitation with animals was permitted by law. And in Canaan, it was commonly practiced. And it's still being practiced today. Linda Lovelace, the woman with a clitoris in her throat, made another movie. I don't remember the name of it. Don't worry about me. I've never seen a pornographic movie. I never have. I hope I never have. I hope I never do. I don't see any point in it at all. In fact, it's not only degrading and dehumanizing, it's absolutely stupid. But she has written a book now called Ordeal, in which she said she was forced by gunpoint by her husband to make the movie Deep Throat. And he forced her to make another movie where she had oral sex with a dog and then actually had coitus with a dog. And the movie is available. It was practiced in Havana, Cuba, in the nightclubs for the sophisticated American visitors as entertainment when I was in Miami in 1946 and 47. It was practiced in Hamburg, Germany, which is the cesspool of Germany and has been for years. And it's probably practiced in other places. And so when God gives his law to Israel, he says, any of you that practice this, that's the end. I will not tolerate that kind of mentality, that dehumanizing, degrading mentality to exist in my nation. You're done. And it's capital punishment. There isn't an option. You don't castrate these people. They were to have their lives taken under the administration of the civil law. Okay? Okay. The third capital offense, verse 20, was sacrifice to pagan deities. Sacrifice to pagan deities. Verse 20. He that sacrifice unto any god save unto Jehovah only. Boy, what a beautiful expression. He shall be utterly destroyed. And the concept of utterly destroyed is like the concept of anathema, only with the physical added to it. He's not just set apart for destruction. He is utterly, totally destroyed. Now, following that, there is an extended series. Point 6 runs from 22:21 to 23:9. In which you have laws relative to social afflictions. In other words, what about poor people? What about social afflictions? Let me get this down first. First fruits, and justice before the law. What about when you have a foreigner in your land? Is he to bear different penalties than, say, a native of the land? Or is the law to be administered fairly? What about a poor man? Are we to favor a poor man because he's poor? Or are we to bend the law for a poor man because he's poor? What about those kind of cases, see? And you have a series of expressions to see to it that justice is rendered objectively. And I don't have time. I'm afraid I have to hurry over them tonight. So I'll stop there, and we'll take up right with verse 21 of chapter 22 when we're done. Now, are there any questions on any of the mishpatim, the ordinances, the laws that we've talked about tonight? Question, yes. Historically, where did restitution stop? Of course, in the case of a murder in the Old Testament, the restitution was a life for a life, an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. I don't know historically. See, wherever you'd have a weak administration, you would have a weak enforcement of law. And so you'd probably have to say that there's vacillation in this issue of enforcing law. Historically, always, this has been the case. There's other times where the law is abused by being too severe. So I would say that you'd probably have, if you had the documents. And interestingly enough, hey, this is an exciting thing, that one of the ways that you do trace some cultural history is by law documents, that nearly always there's been a court recorder. There's been somebody who had to record this, and it had to be preserved through time. And often the case is that is our recourse for information about the history of a situation. For example, in the Anabaptists in Central Europe, the way you study the Anabaptists is you read all the court documents, because they were always in court. Because they were out of bounds with the Calvinists, and they were out of bounds with the Lutherans, and they were out of bounds with the Catholics. And they were just hauled into court all the time. And so when you want to find out what happened to these people, or what kind of lies they lived, you read the court documents. And in the court documents, it'll say, so-and-so lived at such and such a place, and on such and such a day, he said he believed in Jesus Christ, and he asked to be baptized, and that was against the law, and explains what he done, and so on. So if you could find the court documents, then you can learn about a situation, and in often cases you find then the bending of enforcement of laws and so on. The making of laws and the enforcement of law is a responsibility that God has committed to mankind historically, and to be in perpetuity until Jesus comes. And the fairness of that is our responsibility. The fairness of the law itself and the fairness of the enforcing of the law. And as long as we are sinners, we will always have trouble with both of those. Fairness of law and healthy, proper balance in enforcing the law. But it's our struggle. It's committed into our hands. It's part of our responsibility. And so we need to struggle with it, make sure we're scriptural in the thing. And we have to be careful that we don't seek to impose in this age a theocracy. We'll be out of bounds, 100%. Won't work. If a person claims to be a witch today, we answer their claims with good, solid logic and rationale and good, solid scriptural backing. We don't take them out and hang them. Doesn't go today. And if you believe that, you're probably at least partially a dispensationalist. Okay? Let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you for this opportunity again to study your word. We thank you for the reinforcement in this ancient, very, very ancient law relative to private property, respect for authority and personal property, and above all, respect for yourself. We pray that God the Holy Spirit will use this to teach us and to help us in this day in which we live. In Christ's name, amen.